And at 23 minutes after the hour on this Thursday morning, it's time we brought in Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Pastor Robbie is an Anglican pastor based in Virginia. He's the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. And we're after 2 years with you now here, I think, huh?
Absolutely, yeah.
Going great
time
guns.
Time flies when you're having fun, huh?
You're building up the archive for us. You certainly are. Every conversation we have with Robbie is recorded and put up in our podcast archive, so you can go back and go through the history. Now there's history to it, because we merge in and out of liturgical churches, the church calendar. Some terminology is different from what the traditional evangelical church uses. One of those, Robbie, you posed to me today, I asked, what's the topic? I said, Palm Sunday or Lazarus or where are we going? Because knowing what's coming up here is a busy week. And you replied to me thusly, I'll read it to you. Palm Sunday or the Passion? And I asked, pardon me, but is the Passion a way to avoid the word crucifixion or is it a larger concept? And this was your reply. The cross is his passion for the joy set before him. Then you quoted Hebrews, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. That's Hebrews 12:2. The passion is his suffering and death on the cross. The word passion is from the Latin pati, which simply means to endure or to suffer. And Robbie, I took your reply as saying yes to my question.
There you go.
I'm sorry.
It's a lot of words to get to yes, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Good to be with you, Jim and David, on the Broken Road. A pleasure as always.
So I didn't understand the term the passion. To me, it meant the crucifixion, but it's really a larger concept. It's his passion, his endurance, his suffering. Mm-hmm. So rather than it is the passion, but it would be clearer to me if we just said his passion.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that gets mixed in with Mel Gibson's movie The Passion, which was based on the Gospels and the crucifixion of Jesus. And but I had a wonderful conversation with my air conditioned repairman this week, who grew up in the Islamic faith. He's a Muslim gentleman, non-practicing, but he said, didn't the Jews kill Jesus?
That old saw.
Yeah, and I said, well, you know, yes and no. He said, well, did the Romans kill Jesus? And I said, well, yes and no.
Anglicans are known for their equivocation. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is just it. Did the Romans kill Jesus? Yes. Roman crucifixion. Absolutely. The Romans nailed him to the cross. Did the Jews crucify Jesus? Absolutely. The religious temple elite, who the high priest, Caiaphas, even prophesied about it after the raising of Lazarus. It's better for one man to die than all to die and lose the temple. You know, they were really concerned about that. But it's even more complicated than that, because I nailed Jesus to the cross. I crucified Jesus. And you did in your sin. And if there were one sinner on the face of the planet who sinned, for the joy set before him, Jesus would have endured the cross to die on that cross to forgive that one sinner. So who killed Jesus? Well, Jesus killed Jesus in a sense. I mean, he says, no one takes my life from me. I lay my life down. And so if it's true that Jesus set his face to the cross.
It was the plan from the beginning, was it not?
That's right.
I mean, this is
absolutely
God's relief valve for what was going to happen from what he knew was going to happen.
So you get this as early as Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus. When Jesus says, as Moses lifted up the serpent of the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. You could make the case that the cross is being foreshadowed 1,400 years before Christ, before Roman crucifixion, when God instructs Moses to put a serpent, a bronze serpent upon a pole, and that everyone who's being bit by the serpents in the wilderness who looks or gazes upon that bronze serpent will live. And we talked about this a little bit last week when these Gentiles want to see Jesus. Jesus himself says in John 12, when the Son of Man is lifted up, he will draw all people to himself.
This was the visit by the Greek people, the couple of Greek gentlemen that wanted to meet Jesus. And
right.
And we never, that still is not resolved in my mind, because it's like Jesus was preoccupied with what was about to happen, and whether or not they were included in that discussion with his disciples, it's impossible to say.
I believe they're there, but mm-hmm. the point is that when Jesus is high and lifted up on the cross, when he is lifted up, he will draw all people to himself. And so this is the passion of Jesus. This is the suffering of Jesus. This is the choice he makes to set his face, as it says in Luke chapter 9, 51, that when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. So Jesus is intent to look towards the cross, to look towards his suffering. This is his passion. He came to die. This is the entire purpose of the incarnation, is Jesus is offering up himself as the perfect sacrifice for sin, once and for all upon the cross. So it is a complicated question. Who killed Jesus?
Mm. And to me, there's the big writing in the sky, the big aerial message in the cloud over our heads is the statement that the wages of sin is death. It had to happen in some manner. And for most of human history, we had no clue. There were prophecies, there were feelings, there's something built into us that said death is going to happen. But to think that God would come down in the person of Jesus and give his human life to satisfy that requirement is astounding.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the wages of sin is death, and that symbol of the serpent in the garden, even tempting Adam and Eve when the first sin, I mean, this was what God told or warned Adam and Eve. If you eat of this fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die.
This after the episode in the desert where there were so many of the Israelites were killed by snakes? That's the vision I have of the serpent on the staff afterwards, that it became, right. became a symbol.
Right. And in Kings, actually, that serpent is destroyed, the bronze serpent, because people began to worship the object rather than the God of the object. So it was smashed. But yeah, this is the fiery serpent is the symbol of the cross. It's actually, I mean, and here's what we know, that he who knew no sin became sin. He took on sin. He became the curse. I mean, this is in Deuteronomy, cursed is every person who hangs upon a tree. And this is pointing to crucifixion. So you get the fiery serpent account in Numbers 21, verses 6 and 8. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people. And much people of Israel died, or many people of Israel died. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned. And there it is. They know they've sinned, and the wages of this sin is death. To quote Romans, which you were quoting, they're saying this in Numbers. For we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. And Moses prayed for the people, and the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that every one that is bitten and looketh upon it shall live. And this is exactly what Jesus tells Nicodemus. He says, are you not a teacher in Israel, and you do not understand these things? And he's speaking about being born again. And Jesus says to Nicodemus, as Moses lifted up the serpent, and everyone would have been familiar with this lifting up of the serpent in the wilderness. And so Jesus is claiming, A, to be the Son of Man. This is a title of the Messiah from Daniel. And then B, he's claiming to be that serpent that's lifted up, that if people look at him, they'll live. And why a serpent? I mean, the serpent is a symbol of death, a symbol of the curse. It's a symbol of the fall. I mean, if you think about the serpent tempting Eve in the wilderness, and that's because Jesus becomes the curse. He's hung from a tree. If it's true, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree, then he becomes the curse when he's hung on the cross.
There is a scholarly reference to serpents as representing pre-Hebrew godly rule in the Akkadian society that came before the Hebrews, that their gods, little gods, little g, were represented as serpents. And I'm wondering if all this is linked through history, through human experience, to that somehow. Because we know in pagan god worship, a lot of times you're there to appease the gods so they won't hurt you. They won't withhold rain or withhold food, or they'll provide what you need to survive. You've got to appease the gods, which makes them evil, which makes them unfriendly, not compassionate, anything but. So somehow, and this is my imagination, this is certainly not from the Bible, but that somehow there was a turning point, a sense of revulsion on the part of humanity to artificial gods.
Yeah, that's an interesting connection. The roots of this are in Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. God says to Moses in this final speech, Deuteronomy is Moses' final speech, or God's final speech to Moses as well, in terms of Moses is about to die. Deuteronomy ends with his death. And the Lord says, and if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree. His body shall not remain there all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day. For a hangman is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance. So this is fascinating, because you may recall when later on in the Age of the Kings, that when Saul and Jonathan are killed, they're hung on the city walls, and they're actually taken down. And this is, you know, cursed. Deuteronomy says, cursed is anyone who hangs on a tree. The question is, well, who's done something that is punishable by death and hung on a tree? And how is this connected to the cross? Well, if it's true that Jesus is sinless, and that's my belief, Jesus is completely sinless, and he is hung on a cross, and he's punished by death, is it, whose sin is that? And the answer is it's ours. So Jesus hangs, he becomes the curse, he hangs on the cross, he's punished by death, and he's put to death, and that's our death hanging there. That's our sin that hangs him there. Because Jesus lived a sinless life, died a sinner's death, so that we might have life, because he's taken on our punishment upon the cross. And that's his passion. That's his suffering. That's for the joy set before him. That's the joy. That's the laser focus that Jesus has at Holy Week, or as we call, last Sunday was Passion Sunday, or as we're about to enter into Palm Sunday and Passion Week, Holy Week leading up to the cross.
Jesus engineered this, did he not?
Yeah.
I mean, he kept talking about it has to live up to prophetic claims from the prophets years ago. And not everything seems to have been under his control, but the timing, the method, the place was something that he worked for 3.5 years. He engineered his own death.
Yeah, yeah, and went willingly. We see this in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is praying in agony and having stood on the Mount of Olives. You know that at night you can see lights in the distance. And if the Judas would have brought the soldiers to Jesus, he would have had plenty of time to see them coming. And he didn't flee. All he had to do was flee over the mountain, to flee back to the wilderness where he was tempted by Satan for 40 days. The perfect Jesus is the perfect Adam. He's the new Adam. And Jesus does what Adam can't do, because Adam failed in resisting the enemy's temptation in a perfect garden paradise. Jesus, in the wilderness, resists Satan's temptation for 40 days. So Jesus is the new and the greater Adam. He resists the temptation of the enemy in the wilderness, doing what Adam couldn't do in a perfect garden paradise. We know that beyond the Mount of Olives, where Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, he could have easily slipped over that mountain and gotten away. But instead, he waits for his betrayer to come and kiss him and betray him with a kiss. He waits there for the mob, the Roman soldiers, to approach. And when they say, "We're looking for Jesus of Nazareth," Jesus quotes God's words to Moses in the wilderness, "I am he." He invokes the great I am. He says, "I am he." And the soldiers fall down backwards. And of course, you know the story. Peter pulls out the sword and cuts off Malchus's high priest servant's ear. When he does that, Jesus heals the ear and goes willingly with his betrayer and his captors. And the scriptures had prophesied long ago, "Strike the shepherd and the sheep will flee." And that's exactly what happens in the Garden of Gethsemane, is Jesus goes willingly to his mock trial at night, which would have been illegal.
That's what happened with the whole cross. The apostles disappeared except for John.
Right.
Who apparently was
right,
at the John. Cross. Now, there are other times in Jesus' ministry, though, when they tried to kill him, and somehow they couldn't do it. His time had not yet come. So in those instances, he took another way out because his time had not yet come. But when it comes to the end of Passion Week, and he's engineered this, the time and the place and the method, the doors were closed. It was done and delivered. It was going to be that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesus is controlling the narrative completely. I mean, you see it when they try to stone him in Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
And the crowd parts like the Red Sea, and he walks between them. They don't stone him. And then, of course, he's controlling where he is and when. And he's telling people, "My hour has not yet come. Don't share these things. Keep this a secret." You see it all along the way. And even in, you know, making the whip of cords, the cleansing of the temple, when Jesus comes in, he's controlling the narrative up until Passover. I mean, he's choosing the hour to which he's going to the cross to be the perfect Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world.
In a larger sense, there is God's timing, though. That in all through human history, this was the perfect time for that to happen, with the presence of the Romans and the Hebrews, who had pretty well gone astray and destroyed the beginnings of their culture by changes to the law and finagling this and finagling that and taking control from Roman roadways to countless historical trends, this was the right time in God's timing as well.
Absolutely.
Interestingly enough, Pilate was the guy that almost threw the plan off, that almost put a stop to the plan, that almost put a halt to the whole mechanism. I mean, he was the guy that stood in the way of it, at least tried. It tried it once or twice, and then finally just washed his hands and says, okay, do whatever you want.
It's true that Roman history has a lot to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Roman political history behind the scenes, and now Doug has some material on that, Preserving Bible Times, that explains the assassination of the emperor and the assumption of power by a lieutenant, and the decree that goes throughout the Roman Empire to squash any kind of rebellion. And that's about that time that Pontius Pilate was assigned duties in Judea. That is intimately involved with, I mean, it's a miracle that this happened the way it did. I mean, there's no other way to say it. God arranged it just this way.
Absolutely. And to David's point, it's a miracle it happened at all. Because you have an innocent man who, in a sense, is provoking the people to do what they've done, including Pilate. You know, are you the king of the Jews? Well, you've said so. That's what Jesus says. Mm-hmm. And you've got, well, I'll just trade one of these criminals, Barabbas or Jesus. And of course, they'll let this rabbi go, this harmless rabbi. But no, the crowd wants Jesus to be crucified. And they say, crucify him, crucify him. And they let a murderer go.
And that's another interesting part of the context is even his name, Barabbas.
Yeah.
Which means son of the fathers, which means all of us.
Yeah, that's right. And that's exactly right. And we're right back where we began, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who killed Jesus? Well, Barabbas did. Mm-hmm. You know, and we are Barabbas. I mean, we're the ones who are guilty, and Jesus takes our place. And that's exactly right. And Jesus gets crucified between two criminals as an innocent man. And we are Barabbas. We deserve the punishment, and he takes the punishment that we deserve. We're innocent. We're not innocent. He is. We're guilty, and he takes our place, a substitutionary atonement.
Hmm. Well, there's a lot coming up, and I imagine next week we will be, we should take 2 or 3 days next week. Robbie.
Well, yeah. I mean, we could do multiple times because we've got the foot washing, and then we've got Good Friday, and then Holy Saturday,
the Last Supper, Easter, the clearing of the temple, his arrival, and there's so much to talk about.
Yeah,
and so much fascinating context. I want to mention too that Preserving Bible Times is dedicated to teaching the context of the Bible. And you can visit them very easily. If you're on the Broken Road site, just click on the Preserving Bible Times graphic over there to the right. Or just remember the site. It's Preserving Bible Times, all one word, all lowercase, preservingbibletimes.org. And you can go there on the Preserving Bible Times page. Sign up for the Between the Lines newsletter. Robbie puts it out 1, 2, sometimes even 3 times a month. It comes in your email. There's no charge for it. And you will delight in receiving it every month. So preservingbibletimes.org. Robbie, it's good to have you. We'll look forward to next week and go into some of the further context and the events of Passion Week. Have a good week.
Joy is mine, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on the Broken Road. Pleasure as always.
Bye-bye.